And right, so a bunch of experimenters in a kind of experiment here because we don't really know what we're doing. I have a few slides where I just kind of walk through why anyone would want more data with these perfect results that we have in hand. I should say, a photo by Keith Vanderlyn, and there's a theme here. Kendrick asked me if I could figure out a way to mention Chime, which I could not in context, but Keith is part of Chime. So many good things are done by people who are on the Chime team. That's the... what more data do I want? The first thing I want, and people have talked about this, is we'd like really, really to know that this signal is the microwave background. I think Chris established, I think that I'm biased. I think it's been pretty well established that that's the most likely single color here. Let me just walk through this template thing a bit. If the theme here is we're missing data, we're missing good polarization templates measured elsewhere, not in a CMB-dominated band, that we can use to recognize and subtract things from our map. I would love to have such data. I have here an example of a failed, in a way, attempt at that. This is from the last round of WMAP papers. We use K-band as a template of synchrotron, and then we detect that template in the other channels. And it almost scales as frequency to the minus 3.1, which is what we should expect for average synchrotron. We expect minus 3.3 for well off the plane clean places. But even with this almost scaling, by the time you get to WMAP shortest channel 94 gigahertz, and certainly by the time you get to BICEP 2, a tiny mixture of dust in here has synchrotron drops like this, and the dust climbs, and just a little bit of dust left in that synchrotron map means that's the dominant constituent of it at short wavelengths. It's a very poor template for synchrotron polarization by this wavelength. We just basically don't have one anymore.
I didn't notice dust.
Well, synchrotron doesn't do that. We're going to hear lots of, couldn't I put four steps into the initial potential shape and so forth. And if I'm willing to be just as inventive about what the galaxy's doing and say, can't I have a thing which looks like this as an emission mechanism, you can't defend against that. So that's not a thing I know about on the sky. So the thing I know about, and this is what we wrote, you know, a year and a bit before this data release, is that our data are well described by synchrotron that we understand and dust that we understand and don't need anything else. Okay? But the result is we don't have a template for K-band, for synchrotron that you can extend to the frequencies of interest. Similarly, there isn't a good dust template, but I think Douglas might tell us that there'll be good high-quality dust short wavelength measurements, but this is my plea for data here. I want a template of polarized emission at shorter and longer wavelengths than what we have here and at higher signal-to-noise ratio than we have now. Failing that, and that will those data will come but won't be good enough, I'd love to have measurements of this signal at more wavelengths than one or two. Just so that, I've lost my red dot, here it is. Right, this is the inference of the spectral index from two measurements, 100 gigahertz and 150. If you had, well, and in one of those measurements, the signal wasn't outright detected on its own. If you had a couple of wavelengths and higher signal-to-noise ratio detections, three wavelengths, and all real detections, this curve would get to be quite sharp, and we would then really recognize it. So that's my first wish for more data. Please.
No, absolutely. So just the microphone, if you could just get him.
And then I'm going to ask these guys to answer that, right?
Yeah. You guys have the microphone.
So the Let me rephrase what you say here to see if I understand. You have the low frequency template, which presumably also has a little bit of dust in it.
We had hoped not,
but
by seeing that this rises,
right.
This line, I guess I'm missing a line in this graph, and I apologize. This solid red line is a dashed line and a line exactly parallel to the green one.
So
it's just a sum.
Yeah. So then, but then this means that I just want to understand to what extent seeing or not seeing a cross correlation of that map of low frequency map with the bicep in the bicep thing is telling you something about also the little bit of dust that was there. The fact that they're not seeing a cross correlation, right, with a statistically significant cross correlation.
No, they're not seeing a cross correlation, but then there's a noisy signal which just looks like, and you would expect that because what you expect is an extrapolation of the K-band WMAP map to this wavelength is too noisy to be useful. So you see a noisy cross correlation.
There wouldn't be a signal.
What number do you multiply that by to say what upper limit is it?
No, I understand that. I understand.
So a related question maybe is, you know, if you look at the likelihood at the top, you say, it's in, you know, it's synchrotrons all the way over here, dust is over here, and the signal is in the middle. But in your red curve, when you sum the two, the spectral index is not that different, right?
No, sorry. Those are not drawings of synchrotron and dust. All of the WMAP templates, by the time you get to the bicep wavelength, are dust dominated. So the prediction from WMAP is that any cross-correlation of bicep 2 with WMAP will have a spectral index of 1.5, plus 1.5, and will show up here. The thing to notice here, it's a little bit of a soft, you know, that there's a factor of between dust and synchrotron getting on towards 100. So if you were at all convinced by Chris's graph that dust is not completely dominant, the synchrotron discussion happens a factor of 100 lower if only we had a template. But if only we had a template, we should take seriously. The next thing I'd like is to know the shape. There's a bunch of discussion, is this a bump or isn't this a bump? So there are a bunch of things here where data is going to help. And let me walk through them, and we'll see a bunch of experiments which provide them. One part of knowing the shape that's most straightforward and that's going to come, I think, really, really quickly is if we have good E maps, you can do the delensing. And here, it's been said, but it's important to say again. If I measure the E at L of 700 and L of 720, I can infer a lensed B at L of 20 at the difference. So high L EE maps will give us good estimates of the low L E to B mode on the sky. That's this term. And I'd love to know that with more precision. That would allow a shape measurement in there if we really could sort out what's the part of B that we expected. And measuring a shape so that I have a signature is really key. The other thing we haven't talked much about is experiments at L of 10 or L of 5, which see the reionization peak. That's a real signature. You're standing up because I'm done? I have another slide. We've talked a bunch about this, but this is, again, I think just worth saying slowly. I want to say this a little bit differently. Both WMAP and Planck seem to measure lower power than is predicted. The way I interpret this is, the question really is about the low L TT spectrum, not about B at all. And so what I'm saying is the expectation for what they should measure is the dashed line, now that we know R. So they measure a thing which is even lower than we expect than you thought last week. So I'd like to know if that's for real or not. I think it's already a little less real than it looks here. Planck is gonna recalibrate. Their thing will come up. Are you allowed to say this? Part of a percent? Maybe that has a shape term in it. But I think that since these models are the Planck best fit, and that's the Planck data, moving the whole curve up a percent doesn't do anything. So the question only is there a shape part in that? There still is going to be a hint, even if you ignore Planck, that TT is low. Is that cool? Is that new physics, or isn't it? This is not our physics, but some other thing worth exploring. And you can get at that with better measurements. You get more modes. The precision grows if you measure E and TE with high precision. So that's my list of what I'd like to measure. Here's my list of experiments that are in place. I just typed it. I may have missed some. The ones in blue, there's people here prepared to talk about. I think there's no thing on here that nobody on the panel is involved with. Is that right? I could either stop now or talk about, just say what's special about one or two of these that's different from the other things, and then stop. I don't, you guys vote. Two more sentences?
Go ahead.
I could ask the chair, but the panel says I can have another sentence.
Yeah. I was just echoing the panel.
So Keck in particular and Bicep 3 are special in that they have 2 years of data, collecting a third now because the sun has set, with a system which now is, without controversy, sensitive enough in measuring in the right L regime. So that's I view that as sort of money in the bank. The striking thing, well, here. There it is, Keck or Spud. Striking thing is that just this year we've swapped, so two of the five cameras are at 95 gigahertz. So this will be two color maps, unlike Bicep 1 crossed with Bicep 2. Two of those cameras, it's going to be a high sensitivity measurement. Detections in both one anticipates. Those cameras are just new on the sky. The other, I guess, experiment I want to point out as special here is CLASS. There are a bunch of experiments, ABS is one, POLAR is one, which are cross-Dragon, really fast telescopes scanning a big chunk of the sky. What's special about CLASS? CLASS, right? There are those telescopes. It goes to the Atacama. Those things spin. It covers a huge fraction of the sky. The thing that's really actually special about it, and I pointed out here, is that I keep losing where the pointer is. It has a Q-band channel. These are the... So for the non-radiometer specialist, Q is 40 gigahertz, 90, 90, 150, 220 gigahertz channels. So this starts out in year one, and year one is the end of 2014, with another color, a different color than any of the other experiments. The claim is, if you believe the sensitivity curve, but we've agreed as a group not to believe sensitivity profiles, that it does go to low L. It covers a big chunk of the sky, but so do a bunch of these experiments. So for me, this would be wonderful, but this is crucial.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you, Mark. I can transition. Douglas, you're next.
And you gave me a PDF file,
did
right?
I borrow your seat?
I did give you
yes,
a PDF file.
Yes. So let's see.
Does it even? Does it?
Some of the time.
Real.
Very. Very.
Let's get good.
We have another one, but probably doesn't work much better. I thought we had a third one, but whoever the speaker was walked out with it.
Okay, so this is on behalf of the Planck Consortium, so I need to say that. I'm not going to show you data that you haven't seen before, but I can say a couple of things about what's coming down the pipe. My colleague Dr. Frolop asked me to point out this paper in case anybody hasn't read it. He's not a member of the Planck collaboration, so it's not an official Planck paper. Just to remind you, the Planck results so far, the data released and the papers that came out were based on two full sky surveys and no polarization. There's a good fit to a 6-parameter model. In a 7-parameter model, with including the 6 parameters plus R, the limit is 0.11. In an 8-parameter model, the limit is about 0.26. These are 95% limits. So BICEP and Planck are formally perfectly happy with each other, provided that you include running as well as tensors. But as has been pointed out, there is an issue with the lowest Ls. So if you're in this ambulance chasing business, then the plot that has been shown already has a kind of bite taken out of it. I think that's partly the binning choice. I mean, when I look at the multiples, I see the first kind of 30 multiples being kind of low, and some people say 40, and other people say some other number. And it's a 3-sigma thing or a 2-sigma thing, depending how you do the statistics. It's either exciting or not, but it's already cosmic variance limited, so we need to see if we can confirm it with polarization and so on. I should also point out that another result from Planck confirming what had already been seen with WMAP is that one side of the sky looks a bit different than the other side of the sky. And we now know that that's not a WMAP systematic or a foreground. But again...
You can use a microphone, by the way.
But again, it's a 2 or 3 or something sigma thing. You can decide whether you think it's exciting or not. But there is kind of a hint here that maybe there's something at large scales that we don't really understand, or maybe it's a fluke. But there are some other hints of something going on at the largest scale. So what's coming is there are 4-5 surveys. Planck finished in October last year, in case people don't realize, so it's no longer taking data. There were 5 complete surveys from the high frequency instrument, and then it carried on after the cooler ran out, and there are 8 full surveys from the LFI instrument, and this includes polarization. People haven't plotted yet so far today, unless I was falling asleep earlier, but I haven't seen the higher L. This is my version of the current set of 3 experiments that have claimed to detect B modes. So the other ones are a relatively low significance, but nevertheless looks like a detection thing from Polar Bear. I've plotted 2 of their band powers. And then SPT hasn't directly published B modes, but has published B modes that come from cross-correlating with where you think the B modes are. So in some sense, these blue points are sort of lower limits, because this is only the lensing part of B modes. There could, in principle, be more. But as well as BICEP2, we also have this other stuff here. And some of what Mark talked about is, this part is going to be filled in relatively soon by a number of experiments, and that will help with this tail quite considerably, as well as helping understand several types of systematic. I've plotted a kind of peculiar L on here. This is L to the half, L plus 1, and the reason is so that you can see all 3 of these bumps easily on the same plot while plotting a linear y-axis. People have been plotting log y-axes, but then 1-sigma results look quite good on a log y-axis, and at least here they look like what they are, which is 1-sigma results. Planck has a possibility of measuring this, and I don't know any other experiment that can do that. There are experiments that claim to go to quite low L, but from the ground, that's really, really hard.
But didn't you say class goes down?
I don't know that even class claims to go below L of 10, does it? Yes. Okay. So I don't believe that, but that's fine.
You don't believe they claim it?
I believe they claim it.
Okay, fine. Not based on a thoughtful analysis of the class.
Yes. No. Exactly. I don't believe anything to start with, as you know, right? So there are Planck predictions for polarization and B modes and stuff in what's called the Planck Blue Book. That's very, very out of date by now. A more up-to-date prediction is in the proposal that was written to extend Planck beyond two surveys. And this is considered to be a public document because, you know, some Freedom of Information Act allows you to request this from ESA or something, right? So I'm told that I'm allowed to show you these plots. Let me just focus in on the one that you're most interested in. So the pink points are Planck data, except they're simulated. And this is a pretty realistic assessment of pure sensitivity from Planck, based on what, you know, what we think the sensitivity levels are using real data. So this is fairly realistic.
What sky cover do you assume?
And this is assuming, and I don't remember exactly, but it's, you know, it's not full sky, it's 2/3 or 3/4 or something. But and
are foregrounds marginalized over, or just for ignoring?
Sorry?
Foreground.
There's no foregrounds here. This is sensitivity. So this is a plot for sensitivity. And this was made to show that you would do better with four surveys than two surveys, right? But the but the numbers here, there's a square root of 4 or, depending how you do power spectra and cross correlations and so on, maybe it's 4, right? And what's plotted is the theory, because nobody knew what to plot at that time, is R of 0.05. So on this plot, it doesn't even look like a bump, because it's just a shoulder, right? But this is R of 0.05. And is there anything else to tell you about on here?
What's green and red?
So red is, you can tell me, what's red?
No.
red is Lansing B modes, right? You knew that, I think. And green is noise. I don't know exactly, and this is 2-year and 4-year. I don't know exactly how to relate the 2-year green curve to the size of the error bars on the pink, because there's cosmic variance in some things and not in other things, right? But anyway, they're mildly consistent. It's all good. So this is roughly how well Planck will do if there's no systematics and no foregrounds. And of course, there are systematics and there are foregrounds, and the team are working extremely hard to get those under control. But formally, the 1 sigma uncertainty is about R of 0.01. So if R is something like as high as 0.2...
Not dominated by the reionization
peak. It's a combination, I think, of the two. I don't know how the split works out, but it is both. I mean, you can see on here. You could sort of do chi by I or something. So if R is about 0.02, you know, we don't have to do the best we ever could do in order to detect the B modes, but it's still a really, really hard thing to do. So people are working very hard on this. The current schedule is that data will be released in October, and that means that we will produce papers at the same time. And I think that's probably it. What else did I have on here? This is the Planck version of the low L thing. This is up to a maximum L, showing that there's a degradation compared to, you know, 1 would be the best fit to the rest of it. And it continues up to L of at least 50, but this includes all the L's below, right? And the things that we've released so far for polarization, as well as galactic magnetic field estimates are, these are real Planck data, but it removes the lowest L's where, you know, the systematics were still a problem, so it would have been a really bad idea to show those. But these are essentially PR stunts to show you that the Planck data are, you know, really sensitive and will be good when you see them. These are real estimates. based on real data. These are not simulations. And these are showing you the little bullseyes around hotspots and cold spots. And the point here is just that one of these rows is data and one of the rows is simulation, and you can't tell the difference. So we know that Planck has polarization data that are very good, and if we can control systematics and foreground, and we should be able to do the foregrounds because we have 9 frequencies, then we can measure, hopefully, both the reionization bump and the L of 100 bump, and that should be in about 6 months' time.
I think, is that your last slide?
And I'm done.
Okay, thank you. So there will be time for questions after everybody is done, but if anybody has questions right now or you want to dispute any of Douglas's ideas, no? Okay, good. You're not controversial enough, Max. So you had the PDF or PowerPoint? This is your, okay. So this is the PDF. I should go to view.
No.
Where is this? Full screen mode. There you go.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to talk just really briefly here about SPIDER, which is one of the projects we've been working on. So there were 3 projects started out by the late Andrew Lang. There was BICEP 1 and 2, and then Keck and SPIDER. And they all use the same technology, same detectors, and have a number of team members in common. SPIDER is like Keck, except it's a balloon-borne version of it. The idea is to get up above the atmosphere so you have an easier job in handling the large scales. It was built, it was integrated this summer, it was sent off by ship to Antarctica. Well, then the US Congress had some fun, and the government shut down during the period where they were supposed to be putting our base together. And so it was eventually shipped back. And is currently back in Princeton, running right now. A bunch of our students just came back from down there getting things integrated. And I'm happy to say that it survived its trip and is working very well. And we're hopefully going to ship it again end of the summer. Balloon-borne telescopes, 3-ton telescopes, 39 kilometers high, get into space. This is a cool picture, so I'm just showing it because I like cool pictures. This is BLAST being launched from down in Antarctica a year ago. But it has nothing to do with this except SPIDER is going to have the same thing happen to it, and that's a cool picture. Okay. All right, long-duration ballooning, fly from Antarctica. This is a whole bunch of tracks from various flights launching from McMurdo and going around the continent. You can get sort of, we plan for a 20-day flight, which is only competitive with the ground because the sky loading is so much lower that we end up getting, sort of a couple of years worth of observing time in a couple of weeks, just because root n, best way to fix that is get n small. Sorry, root time times n. Okay, whatever, blah, blah. Okay, whatever, doesn't matter. You've already seen this picture. This is the Keck, SPIDER, BICEP, SPUD telescopes. So I won't dwell on it. There is our giant cryostat. It's 2 meters in diameter. It holds all 6 telescopes. It has 1,000 liquid liters of helium, and it's kind of scary. Here it is all put together this summer, showing some things about it, which, mostly the slides is here to say, ooh, cool stuff. Lion's great. Okay. So the idea is to try and observe 8% of the sky, trying to get as much of the sky as we can. And this was an early version of our observing strategy. We're going to continue to refine it, and certainly the results from the Planck EMAPS will for sure impact exactly where we look. But this is just to get an idea of what the sky looks like in the region we're going to look. It's really clean. There's a trade-off between whether or not we include spending time where we might have some foregrounds or not, depending on how big we think the foregrounds are actually going to be. So this is a sort of a naive speculation, as Mark already commented on how well SPIDER can do. SPIDER doesn't get the low L bump, but it gets this bump all the way down to the minimum. And this is partly because from Antarctica in the daytime from a balloon, you can't do all sky, because there's things like the Earth and the sun and the balloon in the way. So, no, and the galaxy. So not looking at those things, this is what we can do. So this is another discussion about sky coverage. So one of my students, Marzia, did some simulations a while back on doing direct pixel space detection of R. So you just go straight from the map to R, not going through EB or anything, just direct pixel space. And this is just sort of getting an idea of everything else being even, how do you want to do sky coverage? Now, this is back in the ancient days, pre-Dicef, where we thought that R would be 10 to the minus lots. And the conclusion you come to is that you sort of want to have, you want to map a few percent of the sky. If you have spider sensitivity, and you can spread it over the sky however you want, the conclusion would be you want a few percent of the sky optimally in order to minimize your maximum detectable level. If you go to smaller skies, then you end up with the sample variance actually beginning to hurt you or whatever else. Yes?
Mark. Is this with a realistic sky map?
This is if you're in space. And you have no...
I don't care about that.
Oh, this is a white noise on a real sky map.
On a real sky map.
So you take a sky map. Right. You add white noise.
So that's all I'm checking. So that this little dip here at 2% is because there is a good 2 or 3% of the sky.
This is because you're masking out some of the galaxy, and when you mask out galaxy, that breaks up your spots. Yes, this is the shape here is to do with the galaxy cut and things like that. Yes, and if you didn't have a galaxy cut, of course there would be no structure.
It'd be monotone.
Yeah, there'd be no structure, but because you have galaxy cuts, it impacts it. Well, we're not, now we're post-bicep 2, so we actually have R of 0.2, the simulation here. And this says you kind of actually want to go for more of the sky. To real optimal here would be something around 20%. This is where spider's going to go, at around 8%. So a spider-like experiment that doesn't have systematic errors or foregrounds, well, this is some attempt at handling foregrounds, can be on the order of ballpark 0.017.
Sorry, I don't understand. How can you have more of a sky and have a smaller, larger errors? That's fixed integration
time.
Okay, perfect.
Same time.
Okay,
yeah, and you're splitting it up. This is to do with, having discontinuous patches and things like that.
If there's one patch worth looking at, mm-hmm. and you look at the whole sky, you've spent less time on the whole
sky. Right.
Yeah.
So at a fixed time, then it makes sense.
And also you might be going to larger scales. You're picking up modes where there's actually no signal. You're focusing on that dip in the spectrum. That's another thing that mattered a lot. You're picking up modes in the dip.
You're putting into this that you never fit the ionization, reionization buff anyhow.
Well, you can try.
It's in the,
and so that's why it comes back down again. That's why here, it comes back down again when you get to full sky, because now you can, but then you can say, well, can you actually get 100% of the sky? No, you maybe will get 50%.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so, yeah, so that's the whole discussion here is what is the optimal sky coverage? And I think the takeaway we came away with is that if we just want to get the amplitude of R, Spider does a reasonably good job. Here's the team on Spider, and here we are in Texas last summer before we knew we weren't flying this year. Okay.
Well, that's thank it. You, Bart. Any questions about the Spider right now? Nope. We can have questions at the end as well. So, Matt?
Okay, thanks. So, you were PDF or PowerPoint? I don't remember.
It's PowerPoint.
Is this the first slide?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Okay, I'm going to be fairly brief here. I joined the panel last night and didn't spend a lot of time thinking about what exactly I'd like to say. These are my versions of the same current state of the B mode. Probes that are out there right now. We have the black points in the upper right from BICEP. Looking at B modes that include primordial B modes, we can only superimpose on these right now the polar bear points. If we also want to look at B modes that are derived exclusively from structure that sit between the surface of the last scattering and us, we can also superimpose in the bottom right-hand plot the inferred B mode spectrum from the South Pole Telescope. And I've chosen to tilt things even more than a Douglas does. And I've multiplied by L instead of the square root of L here. So far, we've mainly been talking about the science that we can get at with B modes that affect it, that tell us about inflation. Of course, there's a whole lot more out there. And I'm very interested in the whole lot more. because the experiments that I'm talking about here focus as well as on the large scales, on the very small scales. That's really important to get after the physics of inflation. We're going to know R pretty well if it is 0.2, and we have this list of experiments coming out. It is going to be known to any accuracy that we'd like. We'd like to know its tilt. And to know its tilt, it doesn't help us to get to larger and larger scales and see the reionization bump. I'll show a plot from Komatsu on that. There's not much about inflation that's left to be measured on really large scales after we've probed the scales that we're already at really well. That's right. That's right. That's right. Now, if we want to measure the tilt, the tensor tilt, not derive the tensor tilt from other measurements, if we want to see the B modes tilting themselves, we need to look at smaller angular scales, and we need to do that well enough that we can accurately measure the lensing. And as Mark pointed out, the lensing is a non-linear effect that takes some scales and puts them at other scales. So if we measure them on some small scales, we can take them away from the large scales. And we are in a fortuitous position for the near future for the first attempts at this, because the South Pole Telescope deep field overlaps with the BICEP field. So sometime in the nearish future, we will be doing this well on with the data we already have. And sometime in the slightly...
In response to your question, Chris gave a date estimate. When can we anticipate...
So getting to those... So the small angular scales... I'm not going to give you a firm date because that's just asking to be wrong in the future. It's not that far away.
Just give units.
Give units? That's as far as I'm
days, weeks, months,
I'm going to go. Getting to the large angular scales, you know, with a telescope that's big and that has a field of view that is relatively small is a challenging thing, right? The atmosphere appears in all of your pixels on the scale that you're trying to probe the sky. That's a challenging thing. That's what we're working on now, too. You know, that... The South Pole Telescope, Polar Bear, are machines that can get to large angular scales as well, but that's not in the near-term tomorrow future. Are those good enough units?
Yeah.
but beyond inflation, beyond whatever is causing the primordial B modes, there's a lot more science out there, right? There's the high L spectrum, which tells us a whole lot about large-scale structure. We can learn about neutrino masses with pretty insane accuracy of tens of milli-electron volts. And so to do that, you need to have a big dish, and you need to have fine angular scales, and you need to be really deep. And we have experiments. We're in this great situation right now where we have this new result, which for many people was somewhat expected, but now we have this line of experiments that are coming, some that are already funded and are going to happen, some that are very likely to be funded in the near term, I hope, that should happen, that are going to get us to this science, to get us to the high L science, the inflation.
Well,
Absolutely. So we have our three.
Yeah,
we have our three big questions about understanding, about doing real science, where we make a measurement, and other people go out and verify that measurement and show real science, Bart, and show, you know, that is a reproducible thing that's on the sky. You know, we have our control of our beams that's coming because we have completely different types of beams that are going to look at the sky and compare map by map and power spectrum by power spectrum. What that's going to look like. We have our team problem. There's no team problem. It's a great team that's made this measurement. But we'd like to see the same thing with a completely different team. And we have five or six of them that are admixtures, but you know, more or less completely different that's coming up. And we have our colors that are coming as well. And that's the exciting near-term future. And we're going to get that without going through a whole phase of new proposals and so forth. Finally, at really, really large scales on the sky, most people up until now have been talking about a reionization as an amplifier to get at the B modes, as a way for Planck to see the B modes and so forth. Now we can start talking and focusing on the physics of reionization itself and characterizing the three things that are in that peak. In that peak is when a reionization happened, where that bump is, how it shifts around, how broadened that bump is, the duration of reionization, and the amplitude of inflation, how big that peak is. And now this pesky B-mode primordial signal, which is going to make those measurements hard, is starting to get more characterized. So it's an exciting time in terms of all these B-mode things that are going on. These are a couple plots that Komatsu showed a couple weeks ago in his colloquium in Yukawa. The top slide is how well you do at measuring the tilt of the tensor spectrum directly as a function of how low you go in L, OK? okay? And the top one is with no delensing. The bottom one is with some reasonable assumptions of how well you can do in terms of delensing. And so the dashed lines that are shown there are for an R of 0.1. And as you can see, as you get out to larger and larger scales, there just isn't any extra information that comes from measuring the reionization bump about the tilt. Okay, but as you get to smaller and smaller angular scales, getting rid of that lensing signal, measuring it accurately and subtracting it away, gets you more and more information about the tilt until you eventually get down to what becomes a very exciting level. Okay, I'm going to say just a couple words about these near-term experiments, a polar bear and the South Pole telescope that I'm involved with. And the really exciting things about both of these experiments, right now we're on the sky, in one case overlapping with the BICEP patch, in another case looking at a completely different part of the sky from Chile, and able to reach down, getting down to the angular scales that should allow a confirmation of these results on the fairly near term, in this case with Polar Bear 1 and an SPT pole. But as we look ahead in the future, we get to this dream where we have these very fine angular scales, this huge fraction of the sky. So SPT third generation, okay, with 15,000 detectors, 10 times faster mapping speed than what we have right now, should cover 2,500 square degrees at a comparable depth. So we get to, with one experiment, being able to measure the lensing, apply our knowledge of what we've learned from that to delens, and get up at the B-mode spectrum. So in the case of a polar bear, we're integrating on the sky right now with Polar Bear 1, and we've already released results in the lensing regime for B-mode observations. Polar Bear 2 is the first of three telescopes which will form the Simons array, and here we have a factor of several more detectors, and ultimately the reach to have a very deep, very wide, accurate measurement that allows us to both measure R and delens. The South Pole Telescope, we're currently on the sky with SPT pole, about 1,600 detectors in two colors, and that gets extended by an order of magnitude in mapping speed, so much more sensitivity, and three colors simultaneously for a much larger map of the sky on the timescale of 2016. So the future is bright, and there's a lot to do in B modes beyond the primordial inflation signal. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Future is what?
The future is
faint.
It's better than results.
It depends on your point of view. So, Rachel, you had PDF or power? PDF, okay, I got it. Window, full screen. There you go.
Okay, so now for something completely different. Everybody's been talking about CMB this morning. I wanted to put in a pitch for large-scale structure as something that is still worth talking about despite what's been going on in the last couple of weeks. So this is a little flowchart. We all did this blind, and I did this yesterday, not knowing what was going to be presented. This was a flowchart that came out of the discussions we had at Cornell just a couple of weeks ago, but I think it's quite nice just to have a think about what we're actually considering when we see these B-mode measurements.
I think you have your labels reversed in the top, in the first box.
Hmm. So, what is that?
Is it, if it's, oh, you mean the yes and the no?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I did this about midnight last night, so yeah. Any obvious? Yeah. I should say that any mistakes are purely my own, and not accredited to Liam. So is it astrophysical? We had a very nice talk this morning about whether it's, you know, all the instrumental and systematic issues that have to be addressed to figure out whether it's astrophysical or not. Is it galactic foregrounds? How well are they being measured? If it's not galactic and not instrumental, is it due to primordial gravity waves or gravity waves? Is it gravitational lensing or is it primordial inflation? Is it vector modes, as some people have been thinking about recently? So if it does come down to primordial inflation, then, I should say that for the gravitational waves, obviously large-scale structure can play a role in terms of giving us an alternative lensing data set. But if it comes down to primordial inflation, which is what most people have been thinking about, and it's going to be priority this afternoon, then in the absence of a viable alternative, then large-scale structure can help us learn more about that. So if it is a result of inflation, and we're going to hear lots more about the theory of this afternoon, then the question, you know, one of the questions is it m squared phi squared, and what can we learn from other data sets to be able to distinguish or refute that assertion? You know, so some things that people have been talking about are we seeing something that's transitioned into a slow roll epoch rather recently, or we're seeing evidence of just after this transition into a slow roll, and maybe it's come out of some bubble phase. If that's true, then maybe we'll see some evidence of curvature that's non-zero. And certainly evidence of curvature could help us try and falsify some of the possible alternatives. And we want to, at our hearts, try to understand whether there's some role in the measurements on larger scales that are giving us some signatures of something that happened just above the horizon, just beyond the horizon scale. So large-scale structure has a role in this. We're not just going to be looking at either large-scale B modes or small-scale B modes and using the T and E to try and extract out better B modes. The reason for this is if we're going to try and understand inflation, then we want to understand more beyond R and beyond perhaps R and NT. We want to have essentially a set of parameters that involve the scalar tensor ratio, NT, the spectral index, scalar spectral index, and its running, but also curvature. And if we're going to do that, then we need not only the CMB measurements of R and NT and the R and an assessment of how well we can do with the CMB lensing to get at that tilt, but also to constrain the multi-parameter space with the running and the spectral index and the curvature. And the large-scale structure is going to play a crucial role in reducing the covariances there. It's also, as we've been talking about with T and with E modes providing extra modes and extra information to get down cosmic variance, if we think about other traces, large-scale structure traces, if we're going towards full-sky surveys in this next 10 years with large-scale structures, then we're going to have other traces of the density field on large scales that can help us, again, beat down cosmic variance. So despite the sort of scrunch on funding we are have been facing, there are many large-scale structure surveys that are going to be coming online in the next, well, there's some currently in place, DES, some coming online in the next 5 years, HSC, PFC, PFS, but then in the decade, we're going to have these surveys pushing towards full sky. There's just a few of them, DESI, LSST, Euclid, and WFIRST. They provide very complementary redshift ranges and data sets, weak lensing and spectroscopic large-scale structure clustering, Lyman alpha clustering as well. And so I guess what I want to bring into the discussion as we think about what we need to measure and how well we need to measure it, we have to also remember that there's opportunities not only to have large-scale structure correlations on their own, but also the cross-correlations between the CMB, for example, CMB lensing and galaxy lensing. So in terms of the effect that these upcoming surveys could have on the inflationary constraints, so all of these constraints were made obviously prior to the BICEP modes results, so on the left-hand side here is some forecasting that was in a paper by Michael Levy on behalf of the DESI collaboration in response to the SNOMAS effort that shows the prospective improvements in constraints. So larger histogram sizes are better improvements on the error, and then the sigmas are very small there, coming from adding in, so the yellow is just the geometric information, the blue is coming from essentially the large-scale clustering from galaxies, and adding in the green is coming from the Lyman alpha clustering. And on the right-hand side are some forecasts from the Euclid, primarily spectroscopic component of the survey, from their 2012 paper by Mendler et al. So you can see that the running is going to be getting down to a few parts in 10 to the minus 3. Spectral index, again, down to a few parts in 10 to the minus 3. They don't have much role on the actual amplitude of the R, but all the other ancillary parameters, and in particular, constraints on the number degree of numbers of the mass of the neutrino and the number degrees of freedom of neutrino are also going to be important. So just to sort of parting thoughts, obviously the reason why we're all here is that this measurement has really spiced up our community within the last month, but what we shouldn't do is just put this very narrow pencil beam On the area of detection that's come from the BMOS, we've got a much more complex parameter space that we need to bring down. Large-scale structure measurements and small-scale CMB measurements, so if we've heard about, play critical roles in being able to go beyond just measuring R and interpreting more if we're going to try and learn and refute about the theories of inflation. We need to measure a full range of scales. We need to break the degeneracies with the neutrino effects that are currently being used to look at tensions. We can use them to reduce their diluting effect of cosmic variance. And we can cross-correlate the signals, in particular, to extract a better understanding of lensing. All right, that's all I have.
Thank you, Rachel. Okay, so now we're going to open up the floor. So I have a list of questions, but I'm going to give you an opportunity to ask your questions first. Okay, Itai. Go ahead. So, and please wait for the microphone, unless you want to be off the record, because these are...
This is a very naive question for the spider. How do you know where your, if it's a sensitive balloon, how do you know where exactly you're pointing?
How do we know where we're pointing? Is this on? Yes.
Precise way.
Well, mostly I asked Natalie. No. we have a collection of sensors. The primary pointing is off of some star cameras. So even though it's daytime, the sky is dark enough that with a red filter, a red pass filter, and enough integration time, we can see stars in every frame, and we can get reconstruct our pointing that way to 7 arc seconds or so.
Okay, so Mattia.
There's also a question about spider. So you showed a plot that answered this question, but I want to make sure I understood it properly. So if R is 0.2, with what, how many sigma are you going to detect R with?
One sigma should be about 10%. And that includes sample variance.
Sorry, I don't understand that answer. So how many sigma are you going to detect R of 0.2?
Okay.
Sigma is
Sorry, one sigma will be 10%.
Okay, 10% of our point.
But that includes sample variance. Mm-hmm. So the it's not zero limit is much more than that. But that's not, we're past that, right? Now the question is, what's the amplitude? Not, is it there? And so we'll measure the amplitude with an uncertainty of around 10% if all goes well.
Can I add a
remark? Absolutely, yes, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I use the microphone.
Yes.
So there are these BICEP2 maps. There will be Keck maps. Spider maps are in the south. The SPT maps are in the south. So it's the same place in the sky.
No, we don't have overlap.
You don't? Why not? Oh, because you're flying in the summer and there you are. Okay. So never mind.
Sorry, they're too close to the sun.
In the fullness of time, there can also be map-based analyses to say, did we see the same things in the same place? And that's a different statistic. Cosmic variance doesn't play into that if you're careful. It's not, once we're past this and we know the signal is cosmic and so forth, who cares? But in the early days, that's a cosmic variance-free important test. Mm-hmm. Which I guess Spider won't participate in because the sun's in the wrong place.
And it will be done before we release. With SPT.
Yeah.
SPT and plot will have done that, I hope. Mm-hmm. I hope they've done that before plot, before Spider releases.
Matt won't tell us.
Good. Good. So, Matt, go ahead.
I just had a follow-up question. So the single field consistency condition says that NT is minus R over 8. So, is it right that roughly you would expect to constrain that? I mean, let's say that's satisfied. You'll know that plus or minus 50%, something like that. I mean, if you've got a 10 sigma detection.
I think this has been mentioned. You're asking how well can the planned experiments do consistency relation. And the answer, I think, from a few people's slides, is that without delensing, we can't. It's like, forget it. To a pretty high significance, we can't. If you can delens adequately enough, and I think 3G is something that I'm pretty excited for that on that basis, then you can do sort of, was it 2 sigma-ish?
Yeah, kind of good.
But nonetheless, it's like not way off. So I think that's going to be very exciting and a very worthy target.
But I thought the inflationary consistent relation is already ruled out at 3 sigma, so, I mean.
No.
That's what Kendrick said.
More data. That's a level we're set, right?
I mean, yeah, it's going to be ruled out at 30
Kendrick
sigma.
Kendrick covered that, and I certainly don't disagree with it. I mean, there's a new paper by Scott Donaldson, which is pretty much the same plots as the plots by Ichiro, which were shown, and it's really hard to constrain the consistency relation. And the low L doesn't really help you, just like it doesn't for N sub S, because right, it's all cosmic variance limited, so you need more lever arm where the error bars are smaller. And to do that, you need to go way down there into the lensing B-mode regime. So that's the future, that's not this year, right? But and you can get there, but you get a few sigma ever in your dreams.
But
I think that's hard.
That's already interesting, right? I mean,
it will be done, and people know it's exciting, right? But don't hold your breath, because it's going to take a while to do.
So Mark, you want to say
something? Well, yeah, so first of all, you say really into the tail end of the B-mode spectrum, but the ratio of B to T drops by a factor of 100, essentially, at L of 100. So these graphs that Matt showed, I think, are pretty convincing. You'd like really good delensed measurements at L of 100, and moving beyond that's not in, what? Yeah. Moving beyond that's not in anybody's immediate short-term plan. So I think we're going to come to a time when we have or have not measured the consistency relation at the couple of sigma level, which won't squelch the most ridiculous papers.
Bart has another answer, yeah.
So you've been saying that consistency relation was ruled out at 3 sigma.
That's right.
Now,
that was Kendrick's number.
Yeah, so.
Well, and Robert put that the inflation is.
Ruled out, sure. So. That was under this assumption that you say that the high R,
right,
is because the spectrum is, so that's a particular
tilted,
interpretation,
yeah.
right? So is the spectrum tilted? Mm-hmm. Why don't we measure that and find out? Because there are other interpretations that have been batted around. So, sure, I can come up with a theory in which, you know, gravity is ruled out at 3 sigma, but.
So, Matt Johnson, yeah.
Came to the right place.
Good. That's what we do every day here. Matt.
So this is a question about large-scale structure, actually. So are we ever going to probe wave numbers that would be relevant to address the, you know, low L anomalies in temperature, or is that totally out of reach?
You know, the prospects are to cover half the sky, pretty much. So you're not going to get the very lowest multiples, but I think there's issues there around also how you use relativistic effects, how you count, you know, how you include those and do it properly. I mean, there's been lots of work on that. In theory, you're going to be able to create what we don't have at the moment, which is half sky, large scale structure maps, and be able to get correlations out to those scales and on multiple redshift ranges. But we're going to have to be careful about how we combine them with the CMB data.
Yeah. James had a question. I saw him too, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So presumably at some point you can also do astrophysical delensing, right? I mean, all this delensing is just statistical in the CMB.
That was actually one of my questions. Couldn't you use like larger scale structure surveys to generate a lensing map and use that for delensing?
Yeah, I mean, you also get the lensing map from the four-point function in the CMB, right?
But so here's this matter. No, but wait, let's just address that. You say all of this is...
Yeah.
You say this is statistical, but the answer is no. You have an actual map. You have actual E-modes. You can clean the map. Yeah.
So,
right.
From,
no. But I,
so,
I,
so sorry, just to clarify.
But I just wanted to address the specific thing. We're not saying here's a generic spectrum and here's another spectrum and let's subtract them. We're saying here's a map which has been cleaned of
each. Okay.
Okay, good, good. The Carlo had a question after.
So it's a question for Douglas mainly. So someday Bicep and Planck are going to meet in some demilitarized zone on a bridge someday in the middle of the night and exchange maps. and they will cross-correlate the maps. And this is a really important thing to do because they are two completely orthogonal experiments, very different pipelines, very different systematics, scan strategy, etc. And that is data that exists now, and it can confirm this result unequivocally because they probably have the sensitivity cross-correlating to say it's they're seeing the same thing. So is that going to happen? Is it going to happen soon? Or because it's data we have now?
Yeah, I mean, remember that Planck sensitivity is not competitive with Bicep 2 in that region.
But have you done that exercise? Do you know what level that is that been quantified?
I mean, Planck polarization maps exist in order to check foregrounds in that region.
Yeah,
but Planck will not see the B modes in that region because it's too small a part of the sky. No, so you can certainly do that, and you can bet that people are doing that.
Planck has Bicep maps that they're looking at?
Sorry?
Planck has Bicep maps they're cross-correlating? Is that being done now?
Does not have the Bicep maps because the Bicep maps only belong to the Bicep team.
Right. Is there a plan to do that? Because that is a really interesting exercise to do.
I don't think that, well, that's up to the Bicep people, but the Planck plan is that you try to do things as carefully as you can, and the paper schedule is driven by the data release schedule, as it was with WMAP.
Right, so we have to wait for the Planck maps to come out.
So the plan is the Planck maps will come out when the Planck team thinks that they're ready to come out, and we're working to that schedule now, and it's hard.
I think somebody needs to do that math, but maybe by the afternoon we'll know. So, okay.
Planck releases maps, we'll have Bicep 2, we'll have the Planck maps.
It's unlikely to happen before.
Yes, but I mean, Planck is going to release maps and there will be no bridge meeting.
Just to come, it's unlikely to happen before, but that's fine. That is. I don't think there's any advantage in the Bicep team cross-correlating with maps which the Planck team thinks have systematics still in them, and vice versa.
Well,
so when the data when data
comes out, we're gonna know.
If they're not the same systematics, though, the cross-correlations.
No, but still, they're gonna clean their maps. They are gonna release them. So will.
Yeah, and when you believe your maps fully, make them public, and do the cross-correlation after.
Just to follow up the last point that's on there on the lensing, can you give me a sense of which has more statistical power, the CMB lensing or that's a reference to sort of classical galaxy-galaxy lensing. Is it an alternative method or does it add statistical power to the CMB lensing? The alternate lensing signals, which I assume is galaxy-galaxy, cosmic shear, right?
I think there was originally, if I pass all literature into like one clumsy sentence, then I would say that there was a hope that B mode CMB lensing would instruct extraction of T lensing from the CMB temperature, and would also offer information that would help us help calibrate the galaxy lensing. So I'm not sure that I'm not saying galaxy lensing is going to be able to tell you what the B mode lensing signature is, but I think that the cross correlations between CMB and galaxy lensing and the autocorrelations in combination will drive down the covariances more. So I'm not saying that one is competitive, and to some extent, it's been the B-mode CMB lensing that has been seen as the cleanest lensing signature integrated along the line of sight. Obviously, with galaxy lensing, we get more information. We get, instead of having integrated along the line of sight, we can do tomography with it, is the intention. So there's more science that comes out of it than the CMB, but in terms of, you know, I think the CMB lensing is going to be an important thing to help calibrate the weak lensing signature as well. Doesn't answer your question, but I guess the cross-correlation is going to improve it on the whole, you'd hope.
Thanks. Kendrick had a question.
I just wanted to go back to Carlos' question and add a quick follow-up comment that it's unlikely that BICEP, Planck, CMB, B-mode cross-correlation will be very informative. BICEP noise is of order 5 microkr minutes, and Planck is of order 50 in polarization. So
can you speak a bit louder? Yeah.
Oh, sorry. So I just wanted to add that it's unlikely that cross-correlating the BICEP CMB B-mode with the Planck CMB B-mode will be very informative. The BICEP noise is of order 5 microkr minute, whereas Planck is of order 50. So that cross-correlation, if it's 7 sigma in BICEP, it would be 0.7 sigma in cross-correlation. However, the 353 gigahertz polarized dust map from Planck will be super informative for the foreground modeling in BICEP. I mean, that'll really nail the foreground question without a doubt.
Thanks, Kendrick. Any comments here?
Yeah, Douglas, that's
Douglas right. Fully agrees.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Did you want to add something, Douglas? No. No, good, perfect. So, anything else? Good. So we are closing to lunch, and yes, so I guess now we have 45 minutes for lunch, and I guess we have an announcement at 1:30, is that right? Yeah, okay, but right, so I think it's probably a good time to close, but this gentleman and Rachel will be here, so you can find them and ask them questions afterwards. Thank you.